When you woke up this morning, did you remember where you put your keys? Or perhaps you've experienced that awkward moment at a party when you can't recall the name of someone you've met before. Memory shapes everything, from our mundane daily decisions to life-altering choices. Yet we only notice it when it fails us. But what if forgetting isn't actually the problem? What if our misconceptions about memory's purpose are? Charan Ranganathan's groundbreaking work, Why We Remember, has been hailed by neuroscientists and psychologists as one of the most comprehensive explorations of human memory ever written. This New York Times bestseller has captivated readers with its blend of cutting-edge science and relatable storytelling, earning praise from figures ranging from Daniel Kahneman to Bill Gates, who called it the most enlightening book about the human mind I've read in years. Ranganathan challenges our fundamental understanding of memory, arguing that it evolved not to help us remember everything, but to help us survive by prioritizing what truly matters. Take a moment to think about your most cherished memories, perhaps your child's birthday parties. Despite filming many of these special occasions, when watching the videos years later, you might be surprised by how little you actually remember. This isn't because your memory is failing, it's because your brain is working exactly as designed. Memory formation happens through networks of neurons forming alliances called cell assemblies. Our brain's 86 billion neurons function democratically, with coalitions of neurons effectively voting to determine what we perceive and remember. Learning occurs when connections between neurons in winning coalitions are strengthened while others are weakened. This neural plasticity, the brain's ability to reorganize these connections, explains why children learn languages more easily, though adults retain significant plasticity for higher-order functions. Forgetting isn't a bug in our memory system, it's a feature. Our brains are designed to forget the mundane and remember the distinctive. When memories compete for retrieval, this interference often causes forgetting, especially with similar experiences like multiple birthday parties at different venues. Think of memory like a cluttered desk, where only distinctive items, like a hot pink Post-it, stand out against the background. The prefrontal cortex, sitting just behind our forehead, plays a crucial role by helping us learn with intention. Though it takes up a third of the human brain, it was historically misunderstood, even subjected to brutal lobotomies that left patients zombie-like. Unlike the hippocampus, often celebrated as memory's centerpiece, the prefrontal cortex doesn't simply store memories, but acts as the brain's central executive. Without it functioning properly, we might remember how to brush our teeth, but forget to actually do it, or get distracted by potato chips while shopping for milk. Modern life challenges prefrontal function through multitasking, which impairs memory and can even thin certain brain regions. Health conditions like hypertension, diabetes, and infections, including COVID-19, can damage white matter pathways or cause brain fog. Sleep deprivation, alcohol, and stress further compromise prefrontal function. Fortunately, physical health supports brain health. Sleep, exercise, and proper diet benefit the prefrontal cortex and preserve memory capabilities over time. Memory doesn't just record what happened. It links events with where, when, and how they occurred, creating that ephemeral sense of pastness that's difficult to articulate. This explains why being in the right context can suddenly resurrect memories we thought were lost. For much of the 20th century, memory research was dominated by behaviorism, which reduced memory to simple associations between stimuli and responses. Most studies were conducted on animals, viewing learning as merely forming associations. Behaviorists avoided examining conscious recollection of past events as unscientific, focusing instead on mathematical equations to quantify how associations form and fade. The distinction between episodic and semantic memory gives humans a learning advantage over machines. Neural networks, which power modern AI, struggle with catastrophic interference when learning exceptions disrupts previously acquired rules. If taught that birds fly, then encountering penguins, birds that swim, the network's entire bird knowledge becomes compromised. Humans avoid this problem by using two complementary systems. The neocortex extracts general knowledge like neural networks, while the hippocampus rapidly stores specific episodic memories that don't fit established patterns. The hippocampus became neuroscience's most studied brain region after Brenda Milner's landmark 1957 study of patient H.M., Henry Mollison, who developed severe amnesia following surgical removal of his hippocampus to treat epilepsy. Modern fMRI techniques have allowed scientists to identify unique memory codes in the brain. While neocortical regions show similar patterns when recalling the same people or objects across different events, the hippocampus generates distinct codes for different events, but similar codes for different elements within the same event, revealing how our brains organize memories by episodes. Episodic memory isn't just for accessing the past, it helps us orient ourselves in the present. When you wake disoriented in an unfamiliar hotel bed, your hippocampus retrieves the memory that you checked in, grounding you in reality. This fundamental ability to learn where we are evolved for survival, as demonstrated by research with sea lions affected by domoic acid poisoning. These animals, suffering hippocampal damage, became disoriented, couldn't remember foraging locations, and ultimately stranded themselves on shore. Similar to how Alzheimer's patients frequently become lost when their hippocampi are damaged. Our brains don't record memories with precise timestamps or GPS coordinates. Instead, the hippocampus tracks time by capturing contextual changes in our environment. When accessing episodic memories, we retrieve fragments of these past mental states, giving us the feeling of being transported back in time. Context is so integral that environmental cues, a familiar place, smell, taste, or song can trigger otherwise inaccessible memories, which explains why music can evoke memories even in Alzheimer's patients. We encounter too much information to remember everything, but fortunately, we don't need to. Memory champions like Scott Hagwood and Yanja Wintersoul perform seemingly impossible feats of memorization not through superhuman abilities, but by using techniques that exploit how our brains naturally process information. In his famous 1956 paper, cognitive psychologist George Miller established that humans can only keep about 7 items, more recent research suggests just 3 or 4, in mind simultaneously. Memory athletes overcome this limitation through chunking, compressing large amounts of data into manageable units. We all use chunking naturally, breaking social security numbers into 3 groups, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, or using acronyms like HOMES for the Great Lakes. Chess grandmasters demonstrate chunking's power. They can memorize complex board positions after brief exposure, but only when pieces follow logical chess patterns. While chunking helps compress information, the brain's most powerful organizational tool is the schema, a mental framework that processes and interprets information with minimal effort. Schemas function like architectural blueprints, providing reusable templates that can be applied to new situations. Just as suburban housing developments efficiently reuse the same blueprint with cosmetic variations, our brains reuse schemas to form new memories efficiently. These schemas aren't limited to physical spaces. We develop event schemas for familiar situations, like meeting a friend at a cafe, allowing us to focus only on what's meaningfully different in each encounter rather than storing redundant details. Memory athletes exploit schemas through techniques like the method of loci, memory palace, where information is mentally placed within familiar locations. Similarly, music and poetry follow predictable structures that make memorization easier, explaining why songs like I'm Just a Bill from Schoolhouse Rock can effectively teach complex concepts. The brain's schema system is implemented through what neuroscientist Marcus Reichel identified in 2001 as the default mode network, DMN, brain areas that paradoxically consume the most energy yet appear to deactivate during focused attention tasks. Initially misunderstood as merely supporting mind wandering or daydreaming, the DMN's true function became clearer when researchers observed it activating during complex cognitive processes like autobiographical memory retrieval, virtual navigation, and narrative comprehension. In one key study, Zach Rock filmed two lab postdocs in supermarkets and cafes. When subjects watched these films in an MRI scanner, researchers discovered the DMN breaks experiences into reusable components rather than storing unique memories. One part of the DMN processes location information, supermarket versus cafe, while another handles people information, which person appeared. Meanwhile, the hippocampus created unique memory codes for each specific film. This division of labor suggests memory formation works like building with Legos. The DMN provides reusable pieces, while the hippocampus contains instructions for assembling specific memories. One of the most extraordinary memories ever documented belonged to Solomon Sharashevsky, a Russian newspaper reporter who could recall information with astonishing precision. Discovered in his late 20s when his editor noticed he never took notes during meetings, Sharashevsky became the subject of neuropsychologist Alexander Luria's 30-year study. Luria concluded that the capacity of his memory had no distinct limits, as Sharashevsky could remember complex information years later, even recalling what Luria wore during specific testing sessions. Sharashevsky's remarkable abilities stemmed from synesthesia. Every sensory stimulus triggered responses across all his senses. He could taste words, see music, and smell colors. This distinctive sensory world extended to his imagination, allowing him to form memories resistant to interference by attaching information to elaborate multisensory stories. Though celebrated for his extraordinary memory, Sharashevsky's true gift was his vibrant imagination. His case reveals a fundamental truth about memory. Our remembering abilities are inextricably linked to our imaginative capabilities. Brain scans confirm this connection. When people recall actual events from their lives, the same brain regions activate as when they imagine fictional scenarios that never happened. The reconstructive nature of memory means our recollections can take on lives of their own. Brian Williams' infamous 2015 claim about being in a helicopter hit by a rocket-propelled grenade in Iraq exemplifies this phenomenon. In reality, Williams was flying an hour behind the affected helicopters, though he did later meet the soldiers involved. Whether intentional embellishment or genuine memory error, Williams reconstructed a narrative that was fundamentally wrong. While neuroscientists often describe memory as reactivating the exact neurons engaged during an event, Frederick Bartlett took a different view. He argued memory isn't stored as fixed traces, but born in the moment of reconstruction, with countless possible versions of the same experience. The hippocampus may help us access fragments of past experiences, but we don't simply replay events, we compress and reconstruct them using schemas to fill gaps. Our minds constantly generate hypothetical scenarios, creating memories of events we've never experienced without labels identifying them as real or imagined. Marsha Johnson's research on reality monitoring shows two factors help us distinguish between memory and imagination. Real events typically contain more sensory details than imagined ones, and we can apply critical thinking to evaluate our mental experiences. The prefrontal cortex plays a crucial role in reality monitoring, with damage to this area potentially leading to confabulation, confidently recalling things that never happened. Imagination and memory are deeply interconnected. Research shows people with amnesia struggle to imagine detailed scenarios, supporting Frederick Bartlett's theory that imagination is a product of memory. This explains why creative people are more susceptible to false memories. Both creativity and memory reconstruction involve similar processes of integration and recombination. Our memories of extreme experiences, both highs and lows, tend to be accompanied by visceral feelings that make them seem immediate and urgent. This creates the perception that what we remember is inseparable from the emotions attached to those memories. When recalling traumatic experiences, we don't just remember what happened, we viscerally re-experience the sensations. This occurs through the interaction between the amygdala and hippocampus. The almond-shaped amygdala responds to threats and communicates with systems that trigger fight or flight responses, while the hippocampus forms contextual memories. Together, they allow us to both recall events and re-experience associated feelings. Our most emotionally intense experiences become indelible in memory because they activate survival circuits in the brain. When these circuits are activated, the brain releases neuromodulators that fundamentally change how neurons process information. Noradrenaline, a key neuromodulator, influences what we remember by increasing the contrast of our memories, highlighting significant details while pushing less important information into the background. Stress, particularly anxiety about unpredictable negative outcomes, activates multiple hormones, affecting everything from immune responses to neuroplasticity. Cortisol, a key stress hormone, can actually improve retention of memories formed just before or after stressful events by promoting plasticity and consolidating neuroconnections representing the stressful experience. From an evolutionary perspective, remembering circumstances leading up to stressful events helps prevent repeating dangerous mistakes. While stress can enhance memory retention, it doesn't guarantee accuracy. Stress downregulates prefrontal cortex executive functions while heightening amygdala sensitivity, causing memories to emphasize feelings rather than details. Chronic stress, as experienced by soldiers or abuse victims, can be neurotoxic, reducing hippocampal volume and contributing to PTSD symptoms where traumatic memories become overgeneralized. Dopamine helps form lasting memories of rewarding experiences, but contrary to popular belief, it's not the pleasure chemical. It motivates reward-seeking behavior rather than creating enjoyment. Kent Berridge's research showed that dopamine affects motivation to pursue rewards, but not the ability to enjoy them. In one striking experiment, rats with activated dopamine circuits repeatedly touched a shock-delivering rod despite the negative consequences, demonstrating that wanting differs neurologically from liking. Risk-takers show stronger reward circuit activation when winning compared to risk-averse individuals. And, remarkably, they still experience reward circuit activation even after losing risky bets. This neural pattern makes them more likely to persist with risky choices despite negative outcomes. For people prone to addiction, environmental triggers pose significant challenges, as contexts associated with rewards can trigger intense cravings that undermine recovery. Memory influences us not only through conscious recollection, but also through an unconscious force that manifests as familiarity, sensing a memory's existence even when we can't access it. This common experience raises questions about how we can feel we've met someone without remembering anything about them. Déjà vu, the peculiar sense that a new experience has happened before, has fascinated philosophers, scientists, and artists for centuries. While Plato attributed it to past lives and Freud to unconscious desires, neuroscience offers different explanations. In the 1950s, neurosurgeon Wilder Penfield discovered he could artificially generate déjà vu by electrically stimulating specific areas in patients' temporal lobes during brain surgery. The perirhinal cortex contributes to familiarity through neural optimization processes. Cell assemblies throughout the brain constantly reorganize to make perceptions and thoughts more efficient. When these adjustments occur in higher level areas like the perirhinal cortex, they help build semantic memories without our awareness. The more familiar we become with something, the more fine-tuned our neural assemblies become, requiring less mental effort to recognize it later. This explains why unfamiliar words like rambutan require more processing than familiar ones like apple. fMRI studies show that initial encounters with new concepts cause activity spikes in the perirhinal cortex, but subsequent exposures require less activity as neural pathways become optimized. Familiarity can subtly influence our choices and preferences without conscious awareness. The mere exposure effect explains why adults are drawn to familiar things. This can lead to phenomena like cryptomnesia, unconscious plagiarism, as when George Harrison was found guilty of plagiarizing He's So Fine in his hit My Sweet Lord, despite not consciously remembering the original song. Our familiarity system falters with faces from races we rarely encounter. Robert Julian Borchok Williams experienced this when wrongfully arrested based on a faulty facial recognition match technology that disproportionately misidentifies minorities due to training predominantly on Caucasian faces. Human recognition shows similar biases. People are 1.4 times better at recognizing faces from their own race. Our brains possess a remarkable ability to detect when something isn't quite right, a human spider sense that alerts us to the unexpected before we're consciously aware. This capability demonstrates memory's most important function, not merely replaying the past, but orienting us to the future by allocating attention to what's new or changed. Our eyes move strategically about 4 times per second, guided primarily by memory rather than simple visual salience. The hippocampus plays a crucial role in guiding visual exploration by helping the brain make precise predictions about where to look. After visiting a place once, we make fewer, more targeted eye movements on subsequent visits, unless something has changed. Studies show that even when we're not consciously aware of changes, our eyes are drawn to altered areas in familiar scenes, lingering on spaces where objects should be. Pavlov's most significant contribution to memory science was identifying what he called the "what is it" reflex, later clinically renamed the orienting response. This instinctive reaction occurs when we encounter something new or unexpected, triggering physical changes including pupil dilation, blood flow redirection to the brain, and release of neuromodulators like dopamine and noradrenaline. Curiosity, triggered by information gaps between what we know and want to know, functions like hunger or thirst, an uncomfortable state that motivates action. Research shows curiosity activates dopamine circuits in response to questions rather than answers, and people are often willing to forego external rewards to satisfy their curiosity. When curiosity is stimulated, memory improves not just for the answers we seek, but also for incidental information encountered during the curious state. Our response to the unknown isn't predetermined by biology alone. We can choose curiosity over anxiety. People who show the strongest learning benefits from curiosity score high on openness to experience, though temperament isn't destiny. The hippocampus plays a paradoxical role in both anxiety and exploration. Damage to it can actually make animals less fearful and more adventurous. This suggests the hippocampus helps generate expectations based on past experience, creating prediction errors when we encounter something new. Our memories aren't static recordings, but dynamic reconstructions that change each time we access them. When we remember, we simultaneously play and record, incorporating new information that can subtly or dramatically alter our recollections. This malleability explains how innocent people like Richard Ivens can confess to crimes they never committed, and how even memory experts like Elizabeth Loftus can develop false memories about significant life events. Memory distortion occurs naturally through repeated recall. Elizabeth Loftus nearly developed false memories about discovering her mother's body based on misinformation from a relative, despite being an expert on memory fallibility. Her research demonstrated how easily memories can be corrupted, as when participants remembered seeing a yield sign instead of a stop sign after subtle suggestion. Like making photocopies of photocopies, each retrieval introduces subtle alterations to our memories. Loftus expanded her research from memory corruption to full memory implantation. At a party, she witnessed how easily a young woman named Jenny began recalling fragments of an event that never happened after simple questioning. This inspired Loftus's Lost in the Mall experiment with Jacqueline Pickrell, where participants read childhood stories from relatives, 3 true and 1 fabricated, about being lost in a mall. Through repeated recall attempts over multiple sessions, many participants developed memories of the false event. Hugo Munsterberg's early advocacy for applying memory science to the criminal justice system has been validated by modern research. Studies show that interrogation techniques like the Reed technique mirror Loftus's memory implantation recipe, creating conditions where suspects can develop false memories of crimes they never committed. In one study, over 25% of participants generated rich false memories of committing crimes after being subjected to repeated questioning, misinformation, and encouragement to imagine how events might have occurred. Despite media extrapolations suggesting we can never trust long-ago memories, arguments often weaponized against trauma survivors and hashtag MeToo accusers, memory science shows our recollections are malleable but not completely unreliable. Most people resist developing false memories even under laboratory conditions. When people remember original events well enough, misinformation can actually reinforce accurate memories. Most abuse survivors don't need to recover memories. Their traumatic experiences remain consistently available, sometimes with remarkable accuracy even decades later. Our mutable memories aren't a design flaw, but an evolutionary adaptation to a dynamic world. Memory updating allows us to adjust our behavior based on new information, avoiding restaurants that suddenly give us food poisoning, or becoming skeptical of someone caught lying. Memory updating allows us to reframe painful experiences by incorporating new perspectives, seeing a boss's harsh words through the lens of their stressful day, or viewing a bad date as a learning opportunity about what we want in relationships. Memory is not just individual, but deeply social. What we remember is inextricably intertwined with our social world. Humans evolved as social animals with brains shaped by pressures to communicate and cooperate. According to research, about 40% of our conversational time is spent on storytelling and exchanging collective memories, highlighting the uniquely human drive to share experiences with others. Our memories and their meanings are shaped by those closest to us. Developmental psychologist Robin Fivush found that children whose mothers asked open-ended questions about experiences and elaborated on their answers develop more coherent life narratives and stronger self-concepts. Family discussions that collaboratively weave individual perspectives into shared memories lead to higher self-esteem in children and better emotional outcomes for adolescents. When we share memories, our reconstructions are influenced by our current perspective and our audience, who can reflect our experiences back with new interpretations that update our life narratives, a process that may explain the efficacy of many forms of psychotherapy. Contrary to intuition, remembering in groups often results in worse memory performance than individuals working alone, a phenomenon called collaborative inhibition. This occurs because group dynamics create interference as we wait our turn to speak while others' recollections compete with our own memories. Group recall also has a homogenizing effect, filtering out unique perspectives in favor of shared elements. The collective memory becomes disproportionately shaped by dominant narrators, the first speakers, and those most confident in their recollections. As memories pass from person to person, they become increasingly distorted, like copies of copies. Frederick Bartlett demonstrated this with his serial reproduction experiments, where drawings of African shields gradually transformed into familiar faces as they were redrawn from memory across multiple people. Similarly, when stories are shared socially, stereotype-consistent information persists, while inconsistent details vanish. The positive lesson from collective memory research is that we can benefit from diverse perspectives. While collective memory suffers from homogeneity, diversity helps correct misconceptions and overcome biases. Groups remember more when they actively include input from each member, whether strangers in a lab or intimate partners. As a society, we can better appreciate our past by looking beyond wars and presidencies to consider experiences of everyday people, including those from marginalized communities. Memory isn't a single mechanism, but the product of a brain that emerged through evolutionary compromises with both costs and benefits. It involves interactions between ancient brain structures, hippocampus, amygdala, and newer ones, prefrontal cortex, DMN, along with neuromodulators driving plasticity. When we recognize memory isn't meant to be a literal record, but a dynamic force shaping perception, choices, and identity, we can use the past to guide us toward a better future rather than remaining prisoners of it.